This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. State Senator Karen Talion from the Ogden Dunes and Portage area is with us to talk about issues involving the General Assembly. Last time we talked was right after the session ended, I think, just kind of got a postmortem report on what had happened or didn't happen. And I understand this time around, some of the things that didn't happen may possibly be brought up in the next session, but only because we understand that the two-year state budget that everybody thought was pretty much set and not going to be messed with is going to have to be open and messed with again, we understand. First off, thanks for being here today with us.
Thanks, Chris. Thanks for having me.
Well, tell us the situation that you encountered last month, I guess, is when the state budget committee last met, and this all, I guess, came to light. Discussions at least came up then?
Well, we have a fiscal year that closes. The state fiscal year closes on June 30th. Mm-hmm. So it takes them a little bit to do the year-end closing amounts. But when we got all the numbers in, we learned that we had a whole lot of extra money. We had an additional almost $277 million in unexpected tax revenue. We also had what we call reversions, which are holdbacks from the agencies that they're directed to hold so that they don't spend all their money. So we had agency reversions of almost $75 million, and we also had a Medicaid reversion. In other words, we didn't use all the money that had been held for Medicaid, and that was another $182 million. Mm-hmm. Now we're talking serious money.
So I suppose it was a very pleasant surprise because even though we didn't use up all the money that we had apparently in this last fiscal year. And luckily, because the budget tells people, I guess the budget agency tells people don't spend it all, that's kind of helped pave the way at least for next year. Or what's it going to mean now for having to have the opportunity to reopen the budget in the next session?
Well, so here's the deal with that. The governor has come out and said that there were several projects that we put into the budget. That we had budgeted as bond issue projects. In other words, you know, we would, there are three university projects and then a new barn at the state fair. And all of those were already in the budget, but they were in the budget as bonded projects, right? So now the governor has proposed that we take all of those projects, close to $300 million worth, and pay cash. In order to do that, we have to reopen the budget because we budgeted them. It's in the budget legislation as a bond project. So once you reopen the budget, then, you know, everything's on the table again.
Yeah. Well, and I imagine, too, there are a number of issues that got brought up in this last session. More money for teachers among them. That was probably the biggest high profile item.
Absolutely.
Although there were other issues too. We know that didn't get taken care of. For example, we know the governor didn't put any money into the NDOT budget to take care of another year of supporting the Hoosier State passenger rail service. And it was his decision not to put the money in the budget for the reasons that he said that basically nobody was riding the train, or at least that was his. The shorthand for what he felt was the case then. So there are probably some other opportunities and plus things that needed to have more money, I suppose, that now are pretty much back on the table to be able to review again?
Well, we expect that they're going to be back on the table. If they decide that they're actually going to do this and propose that we reopen the budget to allow these projects to be cash paid, there will be a lot of interest groups out there and a lot of other people who say, hey, wait a minute. Mm-hmm. We have all this money. And at the end of last year's budget, you know, for example, in the Senate passed budget, we had a bunch of different programs, including a package for teachers and our money for an Army Corps of Engineers study for the Lake Michigan beach erosion.
That's right.
You know, $800,000. We're talking about several hundred million dollars. People are going to be demanding, hey, what, you know, now we have money. What, there was no reason to take those out of the budget, to cut them in the first place. Let's put them back. And I'm going to be one of the loudest voices.
That's to be expected. because even though you're in the minority in the General Assembly, as far as the minority party, you're among the senior Democrats that have been up there, and that's why you're on the budget committee, because of your seniority. They'll be able to know what needs to be done, what needs to be taken care of, and this is the opportunity to be able to speak out and say, hey, don't cut this out anymore. Just let's go ahead and put this back in the budget.
No, that's right. And I think it's another opportunity to do something about teacher raises. Mm-hmm. You know, all of these projects, these $300 million in projects, you know, to take them, and I'm not saying that they shouldn't be done. You know, we agreed that all of these projects should be done. But to cash fund them at a time when Indiana has a AAA plus bond rating and the bond rates are so low, it's just, it doesn't make sense. We are facing a teacher shortage. We can't get qualified teachers. And part of the reason is because our pay is so low. We have the ability to fund a decent 5% teacher raise over the next 2 years.
Do you think that even though she's soon to be basically pushed out of office, that the superintendent of public instruction, Ms. McCormick, is going to be able to speak out on your behalf, and so to speak, and kind of push the legislature to move ahead and get more money in?
I can't speak for her. You know, I don't want to put words in her mouth, but she was certainly supportive of teacher pay raises and a bunch of other things that we have on, you know, in the budget having to do with education, including pre-K.
Were any of these bond issues that you mentioned that had been put in the budget as bond issues, and now the talk is to basically to pay cash for these projects, are they any of these projects that are going to affect Northwest Indiana?
No. Well, you know, there's an Ivy Tech building, there's a Ball State building, there's the Purdue New Veterinary Medicine School,
yeah. Mm-hmm.
There's a building at the State Fair, and then there's a project on US 31, which could affect some of us.
Yeah, certainly both in the eastern part of the area,
right,
to be sure, because it's the route that cuts straight north of Indianapolis right to South Bend, so that would be sure. I was wondering if I know that there's been a lot of talk here for the West Lafayette campus to replace with a new facility the very old, or it's pretty old, Veterinary Teaching Hospital, is what the title is. And it's very busy, but it needs to be upgraded. So there's been a lot of push, I know, to get the funds available for that. So I wondered if that was one of the projects that was due to be replaced, and apparently so.
Yes, it is. That's a $70 million project.
Right.
But Purdue's veterinary school is among the top ones in the nation. It's old. It needs the work. But like I said, there's no with bond rates the way they are right now, there is no reason not to bond this program, this building.
What is it going to take, in your estimation, that will have to be done in the General Assembly either prior to the session coming up in January of next year, or when the session actually begins to be able to make the moves to be able to get the budget open? Will that be something that's just expected, that'll have there'll be a measure or something that'll be introduced by somebody to be able to say let's open the budget again?
Yeah, that would be so. I assume that the budget agency, under the governor's direction, would propose a bill and it has to go start in the House, of mm-hmm. course, because it's a budget, and so they would draft legislation that would allow those things to happen, those changes to be made. And then once that happens, everybody's going to start to talk.
You mentioned here at the beginning of our conversation about the fact that one of the areas that didn't get the funding was the funds that would be set aside to be able to do the study on the Lake Michigan erosion problem. And is that a pretty much a full supported one, where that if the funds are available, that they'll go ahead and get that started? Or will that have to come up again as another bill? I know that you had introduced one and didn't make it in the session. Do you think it's going to take another bill to be able to bring that back up to have it funded?
My guess is that would probably be an amendment mm-hmm. to whatever budget bill is moving. And that's the way it happened last time. I mean, I got that money into the Senate version of the budget I got it in there,
right?
Even without an amendment.
So it would be the same procedure again.
Yes.
I guess it would happen to be sure that whenever the word comes in to reopen the budget for review for all of these things that you want to be brought up, that way at least it stands a chance of getting brought up again. Has there been any other additional support here in Northwest Indiana to help you in that effort to get that money set aside for that project?
Well, interestingly, there was just there was a study committee that met about a week ago mm-hmm. And the topic was beach erosion. And the committee members were all very attuned to the problems that we're having up here. But they also said, hey, we don't have authority to spend money. So they, you know, if the budget's reopened, I would hope that I could go to all of those people and say, hey, please support this, you know, this initiative.
Do you think that probably the fact that the Indiana Dunes State Park is now the Indiana Dunes National Lakeshore is now a national park has a lot to do with getting this get pushed ahead, because I guess it's put more focus on the lake itself?
The problem has been there for years, and we certainly hope so. I mean, we now have national park status, which raises, you know, just sort of raises the level of consciousness for everybody, in state, out of state, you know, people other than those of us from the region.
Now, even though the focus is going to be on what to be able to do with the money that's just been discovered as extra money that bank account opened up and say, hey, we've got this extra deposit or two in there. We can take advantage of this. Is there anything else that you're thinking of maybe ahead of the next session that you might bring up that would in turn, if the funds are available, be able to do more?
Well, there are a lot of things that were in the Senate version of the budget that, you know, I got in, for example, as an amendment on the floor, a raise for the per diem amount that sheriffs get to house prisoners. That amount has remained the same for the last 34 years. I jokingly called it the 34-year COLA, because it was voted in by the full, you know, board of the Senate, I mean, by the full body of the Senate, as an amendment to the budget. And then they took it out. I mean, the Republicans were supporting this, but it was taken out. So I'm sure that the sheriffs would like to see that back on the table. Like I said, we had a method to finance a teacher pay hike. You know, we need to, if we're collecting this money from our citizens, we need to use it for services and not just keep it in the bank. I don't know if you remember this, but 20-some, maybe more, years ago when Evan Bayh was governor, he had a big surplus. He had a big surplus, and the Republicans were yelling at him. I mean, you know, give us our money back. And this became a big rallying cry. I think some people have short memories or selective.
Well, could be one or the other. It's hard to say, isn't it? Well, thank you for bringing your memory into all of this, too. We appreciate you coming by and talking about these issues. And I guess we'll have to wait until the end of this calendar year, or certainly about the time that the next General Assembly session starts, to see if the moves are made by the state budget agency to make the mechanism go to be able to reopen the budget and see if some of these things that brought up will actually get taken care of this time around. We thank you for spending time with us to talk about it.
Thanks, Chris. Thanks for having me.
State Senator Karen Talion is a Democrat. She's from the Ogden Dunes in Portage area. There's going to be an interfaith meeting for faith-based leaders and community members here in Northwest Indiana to talk about ways to help prevent and respond to hate crimes against the places of worship. We have seen what has happened in various communities, not only around Indiana, but around the country. The city of Hammond doesn't want that to happen, certainly in its city or elsewhere. And so the city of Hammond and the police department in particular, along with the mayor, is planning this event coming up on Thursday. Let's find out more about it. And we talk with Lieutenant Stephen Kellogg. He's the public information officer for the Hammond Police Department. And thanks for joining us today on Regionally Speaking.
Thanks for having us on, Chris.
Give us a capsule, if you will, of the problem that you and Mayor Tom McDermott Jr. and others with the Hammond City government see that you don't want happen in the city of Hammond, and for that matter, any other community here in the region.
Well, you know, it hasn't just been, it's been a national, it's been a national topic for many years now, and something that we thought it's time that we address in Hammond. So we're working in conjunction with the U.S. Attorney's Office. They actually brought this idea to us, and we jumped right on board with them. The idea of what we're trying to do is we see this, we obviously see a problem with, protecting our places of worship in the city. Nationally, we've seen several places be targeted. Last year we had, or actually earlier this year, we had an incident where some individuals broke into a church and did a lot of damage inside the church. And whereas we don't necessarily think that the church was targeted per se as a hate crime, it still makes you take a step back and say, you know what we need to do? We need to make sure that our places of worship are protected. So that's why we created this forum to reach out to members of the church and to the public.
Now, I know that you have, of course, besides Mayor McDermott and representatives from the U.S. Attorney's Office and the FBI, will you have some other people that maybe from the faith-based community that are interested in certainly participating, if not being attended at the meeting?
The presenters, like you said, will be Mayor McDermott, U.S. Attorney's Office, Tom Kirsch, the U.S. Attorney for the Northern District, FBI, Department of Homeland Security, and then myself will be speaking. I'll be giving presentations such as like an overview for religious hate crimes, preventing and responding to active shooter events and active attacks that would happen. Some emergency planning ahead of time and just fortifying the different places of worship throughout the city. Those will be the main topics. We will have people, we have quite a few people signed up from our local churches already, and I'm sure in the Q&A that'll give us plenty of opportunity to address their concerns.
I would imagine, since they are very much concerned about this, aside from the churches that have been involved in some of the incidents before, just in vandalism and items taken or some damage done in breaking into a church, it's certainly, as you say, very disconcerting to parishioners or members of a congregation to know that their house of worship is very vulnerable.
Absolutely. And everyone expects that this is a place that you are safe. You go every week, and this is the one place that I think people feel one of the safest that they can throughout their week, and this is not a place that you would ever expect violence in your day-to-day activities as you go there. And to give them this peace of mind, and it's not just the leaders of these churches that are invited. All members of the public are invited, because all members of the public attend their churches. So if you do attend church and this is something that you'd like to go to, we'd love to see you there, because every member there, everyone there during a situation is going to have to assist or help somehow in whatever way that is. So we'd like to get this information to everyone, not just the church leaders.
Right. Now, I know that, you've asked for invitations to be followed through on from the various organizations, the faith-based groups and the like, churches and synagogues and the religious organizations through the day today. And I'm sure that probably since you're having this event on Thursday over at the Lake County Convention and Visitors Bureau facility there on Corinne Drive in Hammond, that there'll be plenty of space there for the public to show up, we hope. And in turn, this way, do they have to RSVP? Should they just be prepared to face a big crowd when they come in?
We have been asking for RSVPs ahead of time, just so we have an idea. But the auditorium there does seat a large number, over 100 people, and we'll stand in the aisles if we have to, if it gets to that point. But we do have on the Hammond Police Department Facebook page, we do have a link. It's right at the top, one of the articles there. You'll see there is a link in there that you could click, and it would be helpful if people could sign up ahead of time. It's just really your name and saying, hey, yep, I'll be there. It gives us an idea about what to expect. We'll, of course, have coffee and things like that available. So,
well, it sounds like, too, that you are anticipating a decent crowd for this event, not only representatives from the religious community, so to speak, and certainly around Hammond and the communities around us and in Northwest Indiana, but the public as well. So you'll be ready for a crowd, and in the hopes that this is certainly a topic of very serious concern, that you'll get some comments and hopefully maybe some answers to some of the issues that you are dealing with.
We sure hope so. We hope for a big crowd. I haven't checked in with the registration, but we do hope for a big crowd. But really, anybody who shows up, we're glad to answer questions and get this information out. And the more people that show, the better luck we'll have with getting this information to everyone. So
once again, this is an interfaith meeting for faith-based leaders and the community as well to try to find ways to prevent and respond to hate crimes against places of worship. The U.S. Attorney's Office here in Northwest Indiana is working along with the City of Hammond, the Hammond Police Department, and the FBI, because representatives will be there from the FBI and the Homeland Security Division, to be there to talk with people, to offer ideas and the like to deal with some of these issues. It's going to be on Thursday, starting at 1 o'clock in the afternoon, and it'll be in one of the meeting rooms at the Lake County Convention and Visitors Bureau, which is 7770 Corinne Drive, which is off Kennedy and I-8094. It's in Hammond. And go on to the Police Department of Hammond Facebook page and put yourself in there as being in attendance if you wish to be there. And Lieutenant Kellogg, thanks for being with us to talk about this today.
Okay. Thank you, Chris.
And you're listening to Regionally Speaking on listener-supported Lakeshore Public Radio. Bernard Carter has been the Lake County prosecuting attorney for, if the math is correct, 26 years now, and he wants to run again. In fact, he's decided, even though the election that he would campaign in and run again doesn't come up for a while, he's decided to take an early decision to get out there and make himself known to everyone that he wants another term of office. And we are lucky to have him in the studio with us to talk about it. Mr. Carter, thank you very much for being with us.
It was a pleasure to be here.
Well, let's ask the question, why did you decide in 2019 that you are going to run for office in 2022?
That's correct. Ordinarily, in a mid-year term, you either make some indication that you're going to run. So usually it's done about a year before the election actually takes place. Mm-hmm. In this particular occasion, one of the reasons I did it, as mentioned, I've been prosecutor for 26 years. I enjoy what I do. I'm very passionate in what I do. I'm an avid community speaker, avid activist in working in the community, trying to reduce crime. I find that that's my passion, as well as in the courtroom, as well as managing 200 people in my office. And one of the things that was brought to my attention, that there were people going around saying, Bernie's not going to run again, and let's do some other plans. And I just wanted to make it perfectly clear that I have all intentions of running again. I certainly am doing everything I can to make Lake County a better place. I'm committed to that. And I didn't want that rumor in the back saying, oh, he's going to give it up. In light of the fact that I've been here 26 years, that would be something that people would digest. They say, well, he's been there a long time, so maybe he is giving it up. And I wanted to indicate to them that I don't have that desire. The people in my office, I have some fantastic workers, bees in my office, as I call them. That's the support staff, that's the secretaries, that's the attorneys, the investigators in our office, caseworkers in our office. They are all professional people who aren't political. the only political person really in reality, and this has been kind of historical in terms of my term, the only political person per se in my office is me. Mm-hmm. I don't try to bring in political people to try to help me be political. I don't bring in political people to try to help me handle the politics of staying in office. What I do is hire people who are good people, people who have nothing to do with politics, who are come with a tool, come with desire, come with the education to be the best attorney, the best worker they possibly can be, and that's all I ask of them. And then in return, the citizens of Lake County get a good product, and they don't get a product that is being tarnished by overemphasis of politics inside the office. And I don't talk politics inside the office. I don't allow my employees to talk politics with me inside the office, and I like it that way. And in light of that, those rumors are saying, well, Bernie Carter's not running again. I had to quiet those rumors to say, I'm definitely running again. And I think I serve the people well, and I'm going to continue to do so.
What was the situation like 26 years ago? Now, you'd served as a judge before then.
That's correct.
And you'd serve, of course, as an attorney before judges.
That's correct.
And probably before prosecutors, too, on cases that you had. But what was the situation like 26 years ago? And I suppose the obvious answer would be a lot worse than it is today.
Yes.
But what was the situation as far as law enforcement and the state of crime, so to speak, in Lake County like when you came into office the first time?
Well, when I first came into office, as mentioned, I used to be a deputy prosecutor, and then I went on to be on the bench for 4 years, and then Evan Bayh appointed me prosecutor. I didn't run for prosecutor. Mm-hmm. I got appointed by the then governor, Evan Bayh, which at the time state statutes allowed the governor to make an appointment in case of a vacancy. John DiGiulio had left and went to the Jack Crawford had left and went to the gaming commission. John DiGiulio came in and took his position, and then as John was there, he got an offer to be a United States attorney for the Northern District. So he said, that was a desire that he wanted, and he's now a federal judge in the Northern District, located in South Bend. So John wanted to be a U.S. attorney, wanted to be a federal judge, so he went in that direction. So when that position opened up, I got a call from Evan Bayh. I didn't solicit it. I got a call from Evan Bayh saying, Bernie, would you be interested in it? I think you should put your name in. Mm-hmm. So when the governor tells you to put your name in and he's the one making a selection, that's a kind of clear indication that I might have a good shot at it. I put my name in. But absent that call, I would have never put my name in. How the situation is today, one of the reasons I left the bench is because I thought I had a gift to give to the community. Not only my legal aspect of it, not only that I had done 3 death penalty cases by that time, I had done 56 murder cases, I've done a host of rapes, robberies, every type of case you can imagine. Before I became prosecutor, I had prosecuted all those cases, and I did real well. My statistics were good, my conviction rate was good, and I had a passion for the courtroom. But the main passion I had was trying to reach out to our youth, try to get our youth to understand that you don't have to go down that road. And you don't have to be in a violent situation. You may have grown up in a situation that festered that type of activity, but you don't have. You can say no to it. So I've been spending my whole career, the last 26 years, doing just that. And I think, it's hard to measure it, but I certainly know it made a difference. I have so many young people come to me and say, Mr. Carter, you spoke to me 10 years ago, 15 years ago, and now I'm a lawyer, a doctor. I'm working in the mill. I'm living good. And I was in the wrong direction at the time when you had that discussion with me, and what you said kind of resonated and is one of the contributing factors to where I'm at today. I've had so many. My wife told me the other day, she met this photographer, and he said that, I talked to your husband 20 years ago, and he just kind of electrified me and motivated me to say, I'm not going to be like my dad. His father was in prison. His grandfather was in prison. He said, I'm not going to be a third generation in prison, and that kind of motivated him. So that helps motivate me, gives me a good indication that I think I'm on the right track. How you measure that, it's hard to measure it because we do have crime today. Our crime is down. Right now we have, unfortunately, 41 homicides in this county. When I took office, we were in excess of 100 for a year. So that has reduced drastically, and I'm not saying it was because of me, it's because of law enforcement. I think it's because of some of the things that is done by a lot of the activists and public service people have a lot to do with it. One of the things that I think is very clear is that society, this is not just Lake County, but society put too much emphasis on law enforcement. When I say law enforcement, I mean the police, the prosecutor, and the courts, and the prisons. They put too much emphasis on those 4 entities solving our problems. It ain't going to happen. It don't happen. law enforcement is a reactionary event. Police come when there's a demand. Prosecutors prosecute when the case is there. Judges sentence based on what's there. Prisons house you because you've been sent there. All reactionary branches. So we have to have, as a society, as a government, and I think as a community, we have to have people being in a positive direction and trying to deter crime so it don't get to us. And there's methods and there's people out there doing that. And I think it's effective. So to answer your question, certainly the homicide rate, the violent crime rate has been reduced, but it's still too high.
We still have problems, unfortunately, with drugs. They've been with us forever, it seems. Are we dealing better with for example, the opioid crisis and with the meth crisis now than we have in the years past?
No, absolutely not. And I give you a couple of examples. I say very strongly, and people, you know, take issue with this sometimes, but I don't see it, the facts are there. The pharmaceutical companies and many of our doctors are bigger drug dealers than the drug dealers that are on the streets in our county. And I say that very, very seriously and very profound. And I, as mentioned, you and I were talking off record here. I was on the governor's task force.
Mm-hmm.
And that was one of the consensus that the task force came up with. And all professional people, medical people on that, professors, law enforcement, the state superintendent of police, all of us were on that committee. A real nice group of people and a balance of people. And one of our findings was that the pharmaceutical companies put pressure on doctors to prescribe many of these drugs that patients later, and we have thousands of cases and examples of that, where people later were addicted to. And once they was prescribed 2 or 3 weeks and they became addicted to it, and then they jump around finding doctor after doctor to give them medication. And then when the doctors finally say, enough is enough, you don't have the problem, you got an addiction problem, you don't have a medical problem, you don't have pain. Then they go up to the streets and buy the drugs. So the pharmaceutical companies as well as the doctors, and they've been sued, and a lot of them have been sued. The pharmaceutical companies are as responsible as many of the drug cartel. And that's the sad part. So that's a new ingredient to our addiction problem. We've always had an addiction problem in this country. I don't know how far you go back in the 30s and the 40s and the 50s.
Oh, yes, that's right. We know this.
Absolutely, absolutely. And you've seen it more now if you look back in terms of the entertainment field. Mm-hmm. Many of our great artists and great jazz players and were addicted to drugs, and they had that underground heroin market. Well, they were addicted to it, but certainly the lay persons were also out there doing the same thing too.
One of the other issues I know that you're very, very strong on and have done your best to push for is to try to resolve and at least try to, maybe better to say, prioritize the sex crimes that have happened, domestic violence cases that have happened here in Lake County. And you've asked for some help, and the county council is doing their best to help you, trying to seek some federal funds. Tell us what the latest is there.
Absolutely. We've applied for a number of different grants from the federal government to assist us in bringing qualified attorneys as well as support staff. Our VOCAL grant, which is a federal grant, helps us employ young people who are interested in that field, specializing in that field. And they come in our office and they concentrate in that direction. That's their main concern. So they're not doing a lot of other different things. So the county council has been very great with saying whatever we need to do to help you get this funding, we will do. At the same time, when we organize the special victim unit, we're specializing in certain types of crime. So I don't have a deputy who's doing white-collar crime and doing robberies and things of that nature dealing with young children who've been molested, or a young lady who has been molested, or a young man who has been molested, yet they're talking to an attorney that don't specialize in that, don't have the sensitivity, and don't have the tools necessary to make that person feel comfortable, as well as presenting that case in front of a jury. Now we have four attorneys that we have in our office that do nothing but sex crimes, and they're excellent, and they really present themselves well in front of a jury. They present themselves well in front of a victim who they're talking to, and how to handle that victim, how to handle that victim's family, and how to get people motivated to want to prosecute these cases. Because many times cases are dismissed because lack of cooperation.
We only have about a minute left here. Mm-hmm. Prosecutor Carter, what are you looking ahead in the next year, probably before the official campaign gets underway, that you would like to get done?
Yeah, you know, one of the things I'm working with this organization, Indiana Parenting Institute. You can go up online and look at them. They're an excellent organization, and what they're doing is the key to, I think, resolving crime. And I mentioned about law enforcement, not to answer necessarily. The Indiana Parenting Institute, their whole method is to work with parents, to get parents to be better parents, to get parents to understand that they are a key ingredient. They're the first law enforcement of that child's life, and they can keep that child out of trouble. They can help that child have the tools necessary to avoid certain things, that pitfalls that other children can't. And another thing I'm real strong on is children having children. We can't have that. That's a recipe to disaster. I'm real strong, and I'm not coming from a religious standpoint, but I'm real strong on, if you want a child, get married. If you have a child, if almost, you know, if possible, get married to that woman, get married to that man. Make that family unit so you be there in that child's life. So when you wake up in the morning, you're talking to that child, you're seeing that child, you're seeing that child go off to school, not a weekend father, or not a every 6 months you're there in that child, or you're sending a check in. So I'm real strong, and I kind of promote that as much as I possibly can. And I know it's not realistic to the extent that it's going to happen to everyone, but it does resonate. And there are people who say, you know, I'm going to do it the right way. I'm going to wait till I get my education, wait till I have some money in the bank, and wait till I find the right person, and that's when I'm going to make that serious step.
Well, it sounds like it's an ambitious campaign, to be sure, but it's one that at least you can certainly work toward, and maybe someday you can resolve, to be sure.
Absolutely.
Well, thank you for spending time to talk with us about this, and we hope to have a chance. I know that you're a very, very busy person.
Yes.
At the County
Government
Center. I will
make time any day.
But I'm glad that you spent some time with us today, and we hope to have a chance to talk again here. Maybe we'll talk a little closer to when the official campaign gets underway, but it's certainly nice to have a chance to chat with you today about the issues that are important here in Lake County, dealing with crime and helping in law enforcement all around. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you very much.
And we've been talking with Lake County Prosecutor Bernard Carter, and you're listening to Regionally Speaking. This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. Check in on Indiana politics from a different aspect. We talked recently with Brian Howey. He's focusing a lot on national news as well as Indiana. For Andy Downs, the executive director of the Mike Downs Center for Indiana Politics. It's based at Purdue University, Fort Wayne. And as always, Andy, thank you for joining us on the show today.
It is my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
There have been a couple recent developments here involving politics and ethics. And the latest one we know is involving an investigation that was done here involving Governor Eric Holcomb. Tell us how that turned out and why there was concern about ethics.
Yeah, this one is one I think people are going to say they are happy with the results, and a whole lot of other people are going to say they're not happy with the results.
Mm-hmm.
Basically, the shorthand version of things is that some casino owners made a donation to the Republican Governors Association. The Republican Governors Association then flew Governor Holcomb to meetings, to and from meetings, and people said, well, that's a contribution to the governor. That was an opportunity for the casino owners and managers to have private time with the governor, and that's unfair. That's something that should show up someplace. It's just, morally wrong, those sorts of things. Well, the inspector general did some investigation and found that since the donation was to the Republican Governors Association and not to the governor himself, it didn't violate any of the lobbying restrictions here in the state of Indiana, nor the reporting rules here in Indiana. So in other words, it meets the letter of the law. A lot of people will say, but does it meet the spirit of the law? Because
yeah,
the idea here is that the lobbyists still, or the casino folks still manage to have a lot of personal time with the governor. That's the part that's a problem. But technically, by the findings of the IG, everything was fine.
I know the concern is because we're talking about for casino owners, we're talking about Spectacle Entertainment, which is based in Indianapolis. And, of course, they are the ones that own the tickets, I should say the boats, licenses here in Gary. And they're one of the ones making the plans for the big switch from the riverboat itself to the inland casino concept at I-80-94 and Burr Streets. So that's all, of course, it happened, of course, too, with the General Assembly finally enacting the changes. So I'm sure that's why the concerns are there, because the governor had to sign off on that.
Absolutely. It would be one thing if they simply had time and they chatted about things, but there was significant legislation that went before the General Assembly this year. And so that heightened people's awareness of this, or the thoughts that maybe something here was inappropriate. Once again, found to be within the letter of the law. The question is, though, is the law maybe insufficient, or does it not pass the smell test, as a lot of people like to say?
One of the other latest developments has come out here as far as an investigation and a result. It has been something that's been chronicled in the Indianapolis Star, and you can always go on the IndyStar.com website and find out more. And it doesn't involve a politician who's in office now, but he has a lot of influence because he had spent time with the General Assembly, and that's what kind of got, I guess, under trouble for concerns about how the Indiana's state and very troubled Veterans Agency is run. Tell us where this issue involves. Involving former state senator Alan Paul fits into everything here.
Yeah, this is going to be a little bit different because there is, with the governor's, the thing regarding the governor, the details of that were fairly well understood. There was not a whole lot of things being disagreed with other than whether it should or shouldn't be considered right or wrong. In this case, there actually are some accusations that what took place may have been criminal.
Mm-hmm.
Former Senator Alan Paul could actually end up facing some felony charges here, and the question is whether it becomes felony or not is in the hands of Marion County Prosecutor Terry Curry, so there will, of course, be accusations about partisanship involved in this. But in the end, in Indiana, the Indiana Lobbying Registration Commission says that you need to register as a lobbyist, and it's a fairly low bar. If you receive or spend $500, you have to register as a lobbyist. You can do so after the fact. So in other words, let's say that a person, Jane Doe, decides to start contacting legislators and eventually takes a few people out to lunch and dinner and then realizes, oh my goodness, I just spent $500 in aggregate. Jane Doe could then go register as a lobbyist. So it's not intended to, you know, it's not a lot of gotcha in there. But former state senator Paul did not register as a lobbyist and ended up receiving a fair amount of money as part of a contract. And the question is, should he have registered as a lobbyist? A lot of people are saying yes.
Mm-hmm.
He certainly received more than $500. And by hiding that relationship, people were not able to determine who was playing a role behind the scenes, so to speak, which is part of the purpose of the lobbying registration that people are required to do.
Yeah. Former State Senator Paul, we should say, is from Eastern Indiana. He's a Republican. And according to the Star report, Paul had received more than $900 a week working as what they termed as a legislative liaison for the Indiana Department of Veterans Affairs. And that was after he had left office. He was in office until 2014. And this time period that they've got him listed as a liaison was from 2015 to 2019. And the latest issues that the Star brings up here about the fact that about this contract you're talking about is that Paul had allegedly been paid more than $150,000 to make sure that the IDVA is out in front of lawmakers all the time. And he didn't, because he's in that role that becomes a lobbyist role, and he didn't register as a lobbyist. So I know that's the big concern there, too. There are all kinds of little twists and turns that you have to be careful about. I know when you have to become a lobbyist, and we hear about it all the time with former members on Capitol Hill leaving office and then becoming lobbyists in Washington, D.C., and that's the same here in Indianapolis, too, I understand.
Yeah, and the issue here is also related to what people refer to as the revolving door.
Yeah.
Somebody goes from being a legislator to being a lobbyist, or from a lobbyyist to a legislator and back and forth. It's called a revolving door. And in the Indiana General Assembly, there is actually a cooling off period. If you are a legislator, you cannot lobby the legislature for, and of course the number of years is escaping me, I think it's 6 months or something like that, might be a year. You cannot lobby the legislature for a certain amount of time. And there is question here about whether he violated that as well. And so that's a felony, a fairly low-level felony. Violating the registration requirement is a low-level felony. And it really kind of gets at the two things that really upset voters. Number one, lobbyists who get paid a lot of money to make sure that their issue is heard, which people believe is somewhat unfair, of course, unless they're a fan of that issue, then they think it's okay. And then the other one is this idea of the revolving door, which upsets an awful lot of people. So this is one that we'll pay attention to. Theoretically, it could raise the level of awareness, and we might see a change once again to the lobbying rules here. Or if he is simply found guilty, people will say, see, the process works. This thing that was we all agreed to be wrong was found to be illegal, and therefore he's now going to pay the price with jail and or fines.
Now, we know it's a little early to start planning for the next legislative session, although I suppose it's on some things it's never really too early ever to talk about it after session ends. But we think that this might be one of the things that somebody in one of the districts is thinking about, whether it's a state representative or a state senator, that maybe think about maybe having to make some changes in the ethics rules to account for all these things?
I think there might be, of course, some folks are going to say, well, let's wait and see what happens here. If he's actually found guilty of criminal activity, well, then the process worked. You don't have to change the law. The law worked. It did what it was supposed to do.
Right.
Everybody's happy. But when you think about, when you add to it what we talked about earlier with Governor Holcomb, there might be some people who will say, well, you know, that's something that should have to be disclosed, or you as an office holder should not be able to accept, whether it's paid through another entity or not, such a benefit for not only you but also for a lobbyist. So there could be some folks who want to talk about that. I think that we'll have to wait and see. And I would argue, by the way, summertime is a wonderful time to be talking with legislators about issues, because that's when summer study committees or interim study committees are meeting.
Yeah.
It's also when legislators have a little more time to be thoughtful and think about what they might do from a legislative standpoint. By the time you get into the session, everything is just, you know, run and gun. It's a high-tempo offense, so to speak, and the legislators really have to spread their attention so broadly to the, you know, 800 or 1,000 pieces of legislation that are introduced. They don't have time to devote to a topic the way we might want them to.
I'm bringing up the topic of talking to legislators. We've had State Senator Karen Talion in the studio to talk with about some of the issues, and she, I know, is very concerned about the possibility that the two-year state budget, which we all thought was wrapped up in a tight, nice little bow with a green felt on it, was going to have to be reopened again in the next session, because there are some things that I think that the governor and the administration may want to make some changes. So she's very concerned about the fact that, number one, they have to reopen the budget. That the possibility, very real possibility of that, as well as some of the things that they'll bring up. Is this one of these things that that you think that, although it usually isn't, that it might very well be one?
The legislators really don't like opening the budget up. They like the fact that it's a two-year budget. The budget dominates so much of what happens in the legislative session.
Yeah.
I think they like the fact that it's every other year, which gives them the opportunity to I don't want to say not think about financial issues, but to have some time to devote to other issues. But there are people who are concerned about the amount of discretion that the governor has, as well as the administration has, in spending money and moving it around, as well as the state budget committee, outside of the budget period. So it is not at all common for the legislature to open the budget back up again because of what that does to the session. It just throws everything on the table and creates what some would consider to be a fair amount of havoc.
Well, Andy, thanks for the time and spending with us and your views on these Indiana politics issues, and hope to have you back on soon.
Well, it's my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Andy Downs, Executive Director of the Mike Downs Center for Indiana Politics, which is based at Purdue University, Fort Wayne. It's time once again for another edition of Eye on the Arts, and here is John Kane with South Shore Arts.
Joining me for this edition of Eye on the Arts is Tim King, the Executive Director of the LaPorte County Symphony Orchestra. And Tim, it's very nice to have you back.
Thank you, John. It's a pleasure to be here.
And we're going to talk about, so the big thing on the calendar at LaPorte County Symphony Orchestra every year is this Hoosier Star.
Right.
And this started back when?
Well, we're in our 14th year, and I've been involved with it for about 5 or 6 years now. It started as it's a fundraiser for the orchestra. Started 14 years ago and was very, very popular when it first started. And as you know, with fundraisers, tend to have a shelf life if you do the same dance on the same date at the same time of year. But this has been really impressive to me that we're in our 14th year now, and we have we had 90 people audition for this year, and I was so impressed with the quality. And these are people that I still haven't heard from, didn't know that they had these kinds of voices. And so we have a youth division that's 17 and under, and an adult division that's 18 and over, and we choose 5 from the youth and 5 from the adult. And so the big deal here is that they get to solo with the orchestra. So they essentially make their debut, their performance debut, with the orchestra on September the 7th.
Now, can candidates come back if they don't make the cut 1 year? Can they reapply? re-audition?
Yes, they can. Yes, they can. And we just amended our rules this past year that if you're a finalist, you can come back.
Oh, good.
For the, it used to be if you were a finalist, you couldn't come back the following year, but you could the next year after that. We eliminated that and said you can. And we have actually a couple of people that have been finalists before, one of the adult and one of the youth that have made the process again for this year.
And what kinds of music do these people perform?
That's interesting, too. We have everything from country to opera. We have one person singing Nessun Dorma from Turandot.
Uh-huh.
We have a Michael Bublé piece. We have rock and roll. There's a gentleman doing a rock and roll piece. We have a country piece. We have two or three pop pieces. So it just everything. Is in there.
Are there individual winners? Are there winners for individual categories?
Well, with just the category for the youth, there's a winner.
Okay.
And the category for the adult, and there's a winner. And that's where
they
we come
bring
up.
Whatever they bring. To
exactly.
The table.
Yeah. Exactly.
Well, that's fun. So there are five each, and the age range for the adults is.
Well, I think they go anywhere from 18 to over 60.
Oh, cool.
This year. Yeah. Yeah.
That's wonderful. And I like the name of this one youth contestant, Ella Moon.
Ella Moon, isn't that a wonderful name?
That's a fantastic name. I see she's from Crown Point. So these are candidates from all over the place.
Well, they have been all over the place. You know, when it first started, it was sort of just our three-county region, Lake Porter and LaPorte.
Mm-hmm.
And we also do accept candidates from Berrien County in Southwest Michigan. Mm-hmm. We just go that far. But this year, we had them as far as Terre Haute. We had someone from Terre Haute, someone from New Albany, which you know is just right across the river from Louisville,
right?
Which is a good five-hour hike from here. So we had candidates literally from all over the state.
So word is spreading.
It is.
This is something you want to participate
exactly.
in.
Exactly. And I think that the draw is that you get to perform with an orchestra.
Have your past winners gone on to fame and glory?
I can't say anybody's on the Broadway stage yet, but we do have a couple of them that have good careers going on in Chicago.
Yeah,
right now they have a steady work in music theater in Chicago right
Wonderful.
Now. Yeah, so there are some that have done well.
So this is taking place on Saturday, September the 7th.
Right, it's at the Civic Auditorium in LaPorte, and the tickets are $15 for adults and $5 for children 12 and under. And we have a website, HoosierStar.com, and the ticket link is up there ready to go.
Good. And you pack the house?
Not quite. You know, with the Civic Auditorium is a big place
it's
to try
gigantic,
to fill.
Yeah. Yeah, it is.
And so if we can get 1,000, I'm really, really happy.
Yeah.
It holds about 1,500. But So the more the merrier.
And finally, who are the judges for the contest?
Oh, my gosh. I have to remember. Reverend DeWitt Jackson is a judge. He's from Michigan City. Mary Kay Steele is a judge. And there's a younger person, and I'm sorry, I can't remember who it is. So I apologize about that.
Do they say mean things?
No, they don't say mean. No, they try to be. But I will tell you that everyone in the audience gets to critique. So everyone has a vote. But the judges have a higher percentage. So the judges have 25% of the vote. And then the audience each gets a vote. And then we have an accounting firm, Parkinson and Hinton, who actually does the accounting for us, and we have the winners at the end.
That's fantastic.
It is.
Sounds
it's
like
fun.
Such a fun
so
evening.
It's really a lot of a good. It is. There is criticism, but it's positive.
Yeah.
We try to make sure it's, especially for the younger ones.
Uh-huh.
You know, you don't need to be tearing somebody down
at all. I don't want Ella Moon to be upset.
Absolutely, and that's quite a voice, by the way. So
wonderful. Oh, wonderful. I'm glad to hear that. Well, thanks, Tim, for being here to tell
thank
us
you, John.
About it. Good luck.
I appreciate
and
it.
Thank you for listening. We'll be back again next week with another edition of Eye on the Arts.
And if you missed this conversation in any part, you can catch it again later on All Things Considered, or you just go online to lakeshorepublicradio.org and you'll catch all of the Eye on the Arts conversations there. That's it for Regionally Speaking. I'm Chris Nolte. We have our conversation about cannabis tomorrow, and we'll be back with you on Wednesday.